From runasradio.com, you're listening to Run As Radio, the internet audio talk show for IT professionals with Richard Campbell. This is Brandon Wen announcing show number 725, SQL Server Tooling with guest Vicky Harp, recorded Monday, August 17th, 2020. Run As Radio is produced each week by Sound Thoughts LLC. For more information, visit soundthoughtsllc.com. You can follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/runasradio.
Thank you, Brandon. This is Richard Campbell, and thanks for listening to Run As Radio. My guest today is Vicky Harp, who is the Group PM Manager for the SQL Server Tools and Experiences team at Microsoft, which is the team responsible for the graphical and non-graphical set of interfaces for SQL Server in Azure, as well as the on-premises tooling. Welcome, Vicky.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, the Group PM Manager, is that the Group Product Manager? Is that really what?
Yes, I've always loved that. It's like they couldn't come up with something a little bit that rolls off the tongue a little bit more. No. We always just call it GPM.
GPM, yes. Yeah, because the PMM, like they, yeah, you get into trouble with words there. But it's one of those things that happens as the complexity of a big organization. So you lead a group of program managers for Microsoft.
Correct.
Right.
Correct.
Specifically around SQL Server tooling, which there is an array of.
Yes, in fact, it's a lot larger area than I think people realize. So a lot of times I think when people think about SQL Server tooling, they think about like maybe one tool. Can you think of what one tool probably they're thinking of?
Yeah, I'm thinking about the SQL Server tool that gets installed when I install SQL Server. That would be the one.
Yes, that would be the one. So the thing is, so SSMS is the kind of the big one that a lot of people think of, and they think, okay, that's the one.
That's my tool.
But honestly, when we're talking about experiences, we're talking about even the experiences for APIs, scripting, drivers, you know, non-graphical interfaces, as well as the graphical interfaces for things like the Azure portal and then kind of the emerging tools like Azure Data Studio. So we actually have quite a broad set of experiences. It's everything kind of outside the engine that you use to connect to and work with your data.
Yeah, that's a ton of stuff these days. Well, the big one that I've been paying attention to is Azure Data Studio, just because I think that certainly the installation impact is nice, but also getting away from this mindset of even installing SQL Server, that the servers are not machines I directly touch, that I just have the tooling on my workstation that reaches whatever SQL Server I want to get to. Although, I don't know, is Azure Data Studio badly named? It's not necessarily about Azure, is it?
Right. So if anything, you can think of it as it's more like it's a name for the set of experiences that it encompasses. So it's the studio for Azure Data properties. So SQL Server is the biggest one of them, but we also have Postgres and we have other Azure Data offerings coming online. It is actually a client tool. It's based on a fork of VS Code. And so it's a daily integrated fork of VS Code, but with those extra data niceties added. The main thing that it adds, like structurally, to the VS Code core is something we call the DMP, the Data Management Protocol. So it's like the language services and the ability to do connectivity, IntelliSense, et cetera, to different named data services. So SQL Server, Postgres, et cetera. As you add those extensions, then the query editor, the server browser, the connection window, all of the Azure sign-in, and for your on-prem servers as well, they all kind of just kind of pop into place.
Yeah, it reminds me of the Windows Admin Center for the same reason that it doesn't matter whether that's a machine on premises in the cloud, like wherever it may be, it's just a machine.
Correct.
And it seems like Azure Data Studio does a good job of that. It's like wherever you may store data, it shows up here and it's able, I guess, you know, thinking about the way you described the tooling part of it, it's able to interrogate the database to give me the meta information I need, the list of tables, the list of stored procedures. Like if you just were working from a command line, sort of the VS Code way, you'd have to remember all those commands. And I really don't want to.
Right. And you'd have to remember the different flavors or the different places that you have it installed. And in some cases, you'd have to keep quite a lot top of mind as far as how do you connect to it, what's the authentication method, et cetera.
Yeah, it's a lot more plumbing stuff I don't want in my head.
Right. And then the other thing that it brings is it's cross-platform and, you know, so it's open source.
Right.
So it's kind of got that, it releases monthly. It's kind of a contemporary approach to the tooling, because I mean, SQL Server has been around for a really long time now, it's gone through a couple different iterations of tooling. And like the contemporary approach to it is this, you know, lighter weight, Electron based, cross-platform tool set. And it's also important because like Visual Studio has gone kind of cross-platform. SQL Server itself is now cross-platform. You can install it on Linux and Kubernetes containers, et cetera.
Yeah. So your SQL Server showing up in more places, whether on-prem or in the cloud, plus all these other database offerings now. I mean, certainly Postgres, MySQL, Maria. I don't even know if I can name them all anymore. The list of stuff in Azure is crazy.
Yeah. And so that really increases kind of the scope of Azure Data Studio. So going back to your question about the name, you know, when we first came out with it, it had kind of a SQL based name.
Right.
And then that was going to cause confusion right off the bat. As you were like,
yeah, no, I need a tool to manage Postgres. Like that's not for me then.
Right. Exactly. So the name of the division is Azure Data. So it makes sense in that sense, but then people hear it and they're like, oh, well, I'm all on-prem. And so this must not be for me. And that's actually not accurate. It works for an entirely on-prem.
Maybe there is no perfect name. Like I totally get the problem you're in. If I name it too much on-premy, people won't do the Azure stuff with it. If I name it too SQL Server-y, people won't do the other databases with it. If I make it too cloudy, then folks are like, oh, I need on-prem stuff. Like, you're kind of stuck.
Right. No, it's hard. Naming stuff is hard. It's like, you know, making a product, you know, doing user studies, that's all easy. Naming it.
That's easy. Naming it a good name. Yeah. Getting it through legal.
Yes. Yeah. And then, you know, there's always that joke about, bike shedding where you can, you know.
Well, it looks like a trivial problem. And that's like, the bike shed case is it looked like a trivial problem and it just isn't.
It just isn't. And so I think the main thing is once people give it a shot, you know, they normally just kind of get it, but it's a matter of getting it in front of people and letting them give it a try, see how it feels. And then also getting them used to the idea that it changes much more quickly than maybe they're used to with the big enterprise tools because they're shipping on a monthly basis.
That is an interesting aspect, especially in the IT world where we're often the shepherds of what updates do we take and when do we take them. So the fact that the cadence is so high is often distressing for IT folks. Mm-hmm. Not that it seems to me like I've got Azure Data Studio hanging around and the updates don't seem earth shattering. Mm-hmm. Like they're very incremental because they are so frequent. You pretty much get it every time you start the thing up, you get an update.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what happens is we have multiple update channels and one of them is the insiders channel, and insiders, you get daily updates. Like whatever was checked in by engineers the day before is going to be in that build the next day. And it's the one that we use for testing. So it lets us let the rest of the community test. Mm-hmm. And then the monthly stable releases are the ones that have kind of gone through our GA process. You know, they've gone through accessibility testing or, you know, security reviews and privacy reviews, et cetera. So there's this kind of process of holding these two things at the same time. So we'll have a feature that will show up in an insider's build, and it might live there for months while it's being finalized and finished and reviewed and everything like that. And then when it goes out to stable, it kind of feels like, oh, this is happening really fast, but you kind of see the precursors to it sometimes many months before.
It's interesting. I could think of how, you know, you have a secondary workstation that you could have that insider's build on if you really want to see the new stuff. But if you need to work every day, stick with the stable builds.
Oh, they actually install side by side. So
do they really? Oh, that's lovely.
They really do.
Because the other thing I would think of, again, having been worked on large scale projects is the localization issues. Like you could build a feature, but will it work in a right to left language? Like, those are hard stuff, things to test. Like, that takes a while.
Yeah, it does take a while. And the other thing is, whenever you're releasing on a monthly basis, it's maybe a little bit lower stakes whenever you find out that there was something that didn't work of this sort of non-production impact. Whenever you find out, oh, you know what, this color contrast, didn't
too
care
hard,
for
yeah.
it.
It's tough to read.
You know, fix it in a week. You know, it's not... Oh, look, pick it up.
Well, knowing someone has a stable build on another icon right next to this new build, so they can always go to one they can count on. And I didn't want to make the whole show about Azure Data Studio, but I am a fan. Just, you know, hope you'll pass that along. You guys have done good work. Other tools we should be talking about?
So, well, I guess one of the interesting things is, you know, with one of the big initiatives for us is Jupyter Notebooks.
Oh, yeah.
But the vehicle for us shipping those is, again, Azure Data Studio. So in a way, I'm kind of talking about that again.
Okay.
And so so there's Jupyter Notebooks. And then there's actually, you know, a lot of people do want to talk about the future of SSMS because yeah. SSMS is an extremely widely used tool. It's a valuable tool and it's a venerable tool. It's great.
Yeah. The question is, does it stay relevant? Like that's, I think folks get afraid. It's like, if I'm not using Data Studio or Jupyter Notebooks and things like that, am I behind on the times? SSMS has served me very well.
Right. And so SSMS is certainly not something that we're in the process of getting rid of or doing away with. And that's kind of the main thing that I think people hear and they see that there's a new tool coming up and they get concerned about it. What we're not doing is adding net new interaction methods into SSMS. So if you think about SSMS, it's based on the Visual Studio Core.
Yep.
It's Windows only. It's 32-bit.
Right. And it's for SQL Server. So.
And it's for SQL Server.
Right.
So if we're going to add something like Jupyter Notebook support, we're going to add it to Azure Data Studio because Azure Data Studio, you get cross-platform. You get 64-bit. You get monthly releases and you get support of all these other data types. Whereas if we were to put that engineering effort into putting it into SSMS, you would be going in with the set of limitations that SSMS has. So those net new ways of working with data, new experiments around things like program synthesis by examples and notebooks, and we're looking at, you know, futurist forms of accessible diagramming, things like that. Those are probably going to be landing in Azure Data Studio, along with a lot of the like edge and hybrid type features going into future versions of SQL Server. But the kind of bread and butter administration and development experiences that you have in SSMS will be maintained and continue to evolve. It's just that the really tip of the arrow stuff will probably be landing in Azure Data Studio.
Yeah, I also think about my hiring as a senior DBA bringing new people in. If they live on Macs, like they're just not going to run SSMS. They're going to go to Data Studio right away. So you are going to end up with a generation of folks working in different ways that are going to be more interested in those tools. And of course, the diversity of data stores that we're now confronted with most organizations.
There's that. And then there's just the things like Git and Git integration that you have in Azure Data Studio, where in SSMS, you can get source control. There's ways of doing it, but with Azure Data Studio, it's kind of more built into the workflow. There's things like Azure login, cloud logins are built in understanding from the ground up that that's part of the modern workflow, whereas in SSMS, it's a 15-year-old tool. Some of these things were kind of bolted on 10 years into the process, and it is what it is, but sometimes it's not as clean as it can be if it's kind of built into the DNA of the product.
Well, I guess then the question is, like, are you going to continue to improve that aspect of SSMS? Because I do want source control everywhere.
Yeah. And so with source control in particular, it's some of it is to do with the actual source control integration. Mm-hmm. And some of it's to do with kind of the nice to have features. So with being a downstream fork of VS Code, Azure Data Studio has all of the, you know, beautiful Git UI work.
Yeah. All the stuff that the devs got.
All the dev stuff. And you've got the integrated terminal and you've got things like that. And you've got the ability to install extensions for the different types of source control you have.
Right.
And also, in Azure Data Studio, we're adding SQL project support, which is coming out of Visual Studio, where you have, you know, SSDT as was SQL projects and Visual Studios as we currently call it. And sort of that project support and the ability to create deployments and everything like that, that's coming into Azure Data Studio. And again, you have that developer mindset where you're going to be doing projects. SSMS has that to a certain extent, but it's, you know, it's got some solutions and things, but it's not really as crisp. It's kind of hard to put my finger on it. I think people know what they have in SSMS, and we won't be making massive changes to that.
What you don't want to do is derail those folks.
Right, exactly.
We kind of look at the modern workflow of a DBA today, the way we're updating databases and the way we're pushing changes and so forth. It does seem to me a big enough shift that you would have to re-architect SSMS to be good at that. And better to leave it the way it is for the folks who know how to use it while building a new tool that is built with that workflow in mind.
Right. And then the other thing we're doing is we're bringing the tools closer together through integration so that We don't want people who are using SSMS to feel like, oh, I'm just on the old thing and I don't have any access to things. So
I'm isolated. Yeah.
Yeah. So now we have the ability to do things like you can right click and say new notebook, and it's going to open it in Azure Data Studio, but with the context from where you were working in SSMS.
That's cool. I like that.
You can do things like do the generate scripts wizard in SSMS and say, I want to generate these scripts into a notebook rather than to the clipboard. And then that notebook will open in Azure Data Studio. So we have some of those integrations. And over in Azure Data Studio, if you're on Windows, you can also run this integration that is able to open the dialog windows from SSMS without actually opening all of SSMS. Architecturally, SSMS has a lot of modeless dialogues, if you think about the way it works. If you go to agent or if you go to do different wizards, they're modeless. And so there's nothing requiring SSMS to actually be open behind it. So it can be Azure Data Studio that is opening those dialogues. So we can do kind of two-way integration that way just because of the way that it's architected.
Awesome. That's really cool. And I appreciate that, you know, keeping that integration up as well. And I'm going to interrupt for one moment for this very important message. Are you wasting valuable time trying to find the cause of SQL Server performance problems? SentryOne Monitor gets you right to the information you need to find and fix performance issues in SQL Server. SentryOne Monitor delivers powerful monitoring capabilities in a secure cloud solution that makes it easy to optimize SQL Server performance. Because there is less to install and configure, you can quickly start monitoring. And it runs in the browser. You and your team can access query plans, performance data from anywhere. With SentryOne Monitor, you can watch up to 10 database targets running on your local network or on AWS or Azure. You can also monitor Azure SQL Database, Managed Instance, or Amazon RDS. SentryOne Monitor helps you find and fix long-running queries that are dragging down SQL Server performance. You can set alerts that are relevant to your environment, and you can easily share monitoring dashboards with others in your organization. Tired of wasting time trying to fix your SQL Server performance? Take SentryOne Monitor for a test drive. Go to SentryOne.com/runasradio for a free trial and a 15% discount on your first year subscription. That's SentryOne.com/runasradio. And we're back. It's Run As Radio. I'm Richard Campbell. That's Vicky Harp. And we're talking a bit about the tooling inside of SQL Server. And I think we need to talk about notebooks for a while because you said it so casually. And I think when folks get their head around what these notebooks really mean, it's always something we always did, but did it the hard way. And this seems like the easy way.
It is really interesting. So I think that people, when they have heard of notebooks, if they've heard about them, they've heard about them in a data science.
Right, right. The machine learning type things.
Machine learning. They're thinking about Python. They're thinking about, maybe they're thinking about Spark and big data. But what we found is we actually kind of came across this organically. For SQL Server 2019, for big data clusters, we needed a way for people to have a Spark experience because it's Spark with SQL Server running on Kubernetes. So we started looking into notebooks, and really the moment that we put a notebook experience in front of a user, they were like, oh, but can I run SQL? And oh, but can I do this? No, but can I do that? And the way that you interact with the data flow so naturally in notebooks that people, once they have their hands on it, they want to do so much with it. So we've just been running to keep up. So for people who don't know what a notebook is, they think, go into it thinking, oh, they're thinking of OneNote, right?
Yeah,
they're
totally.
Thinking, oh, it's, yeah. And OneNote is a beautiful tool, but it's got a couple, you know, limitations to it. And I think people just hear notebook and they think that those limitations must apply to Jupyter notebooks as well. But with Jupyter notebooks, you're able to separate your human readable code from your executable code. Your human readable markdown from your executable code. And then you can also store the results of your code. So let's say that you had a SQL Server script, that was, 8,000 lines of code. These things happen. People have these. They pass them around.
100%.
And when you take it into a notebook, you can say, I'm going to break it up into a bunch of different cells so that some of this is instructions and some of this is executable. And then whenever I run it, I want all of the results to be inlined with the code that it ran. So I can say, give me a list of databases, and then right under it will be a list of those databases, and then it goes on.
Right.
What we have always had before is this concept of here's your code, and then here's also your list of results, and you have to kind of, through your brain power, push them back together to understand
them in
what
sync,
they are.
Right.
Or you're doing print statements or you're doing something funny like that.
Yeah.
And then if you hit, you know, Control S, you're saving the code, but you're not saving the results. If you want to save the results, you have to export them to CSV or something like that. With a notebook, we have the ability to do something like have somebody write up a troubleshooting guide. And then they can give it out to their organization. Let's say a senior DBA says, this is the troubleshooting guide. Give it to a on-call DBA. They run it and then they got the results. They save it and they can send it back and say, hey, take a look at the results. See what it is. You're not having to remote over into somebody else's machine,
right,
something like that.
And then they're very shareable.
Extremely shareable. And they've got kind of a source controllable nature to them from the base. And so this is something that internally we're making a lot of hay with. So we've got a lot of internal troubleshooting, if you can think about it.
Sure.
So whenever somebody has a support call with SQL Server, you know, we've got all of these troubleshooting guides. So for SQL 2019 with the big data clusters, we actually took the set of troubleshooters that we have for internal purposes and we shipped them inside the product as what's called a Jupyter book. So a Jupyter book is a collection of different Jupyter notebooks that have like a table of contents and some sort of organized structure. And so you can actually run the same troubleshooting notebooks that our engineers internally would be running if they had hands on your system.
Nice. So you're literally using the same kind of tools. But I also could imagine in that help desk scenario where you're working through, you think you've diagnosed the problem of the person remotely, you're working through the script essentially and executing different blocks. When you find an exception, like they did something a little different or came up with a different problem, you could add that to the notebook.
Right, exactly.
And have it in line where people would find it. Sometimes you'll get this result, it means this.
Right. You can have that. You can have actually some branching logic. You can have things to say, if this happened, do this other thing.
Go over here. Yeah.
Go over here or, you know, run this cell versus that cell, based on what happened before. And, the other thing that it's nice is that it does capture the error.
Right.
As one of the results. So one of the uses that we have now for, notebooks is for deployments. So we have this situation where the person who can enter all the information into the wizard might not be the person who has permission to execute it.
Right.
That might be a separation of duties, especially when you're talking about a cloud context where somebody else might have the ability to spin up resources, whereas the DBA might be the person who knows what needs to go onto those resources once they're ready. So you have the ability to go through a wizard and have it scripted all out to a notebook that you can then send to someone and say, hey, please run this. Then when they run it and on the 18th cell, they get an error, they save it and send it back. And it's like, look, you can see the first 17 ran. Here's the 18th cell. And here's what the error was. They can fix it, send it back, and then they can resume the deployment. It's
magic.
Not this, you know, oh, let me walk over to your desk situation.
Which these days is particularly hard option.
Yes, exactly.
So, yeah, it's interesting to think about in context of the pandemic forcing us to get better at relaying information between each other. Because we can't just sit together and hammer it through.
Right.
And by the byproduct of that, actually better documentation, you're less likely to make that, have that problem again.
Right. Exactly. And honestly, if I think about one of the things that I'm wanting to do overall in tools is that I want users to spend more time doing the thing that they add value to and not doing things and learning things based on care and feeding of a system.
Yeah.
Right. So having to kind of know all of these little details, like we talked about earlier, and like knowing exactly what the command is to do this or that, that's valuable once you get to it, but it's not inclusive. It's not bringing in new people.
Yeah.
And it's not empowering people. And so if we can make as much of that invisible as we can, then people can just get to the business of what they were trying to do with the data.
Yeah. It's all the value behaviors rather than the plumbing behaviors.
I really believe that some of the most valuable experiences in computing are the invisible ones.
Right.
And you find that when you're watching a user. So you ask a user what they're doing, they'll tell you two or three steps. If you watch them do it, they are also doing other little things like, oh, I'm actually copying this and then I'm pasting it in Notepad to get rid of the formatting and then I'm repasting it over there. And they didn't tell you that.
No.
They just told you, I just copied it from here to there.
Also, lots of little preventative behaviors. Like, I'm keeping this key because sometimes this fails and I'm going to need this key maybe.
Right.
Right. And there are challenges to workflow that you could make so much simpler as the tool builder.
Right. Exactly. And so when those little things are taken away and done naturally, then you don't have to have that sort of expertise to get something done. It's like this, the expertise you have can actually be domain expertise, not like how to make this tool cooperate with me.
Your talent with the tool versus your talent with the data.
Correct.
That's really interesting. And a great thought around good tool building. Mm-hmm. Like it, you know, it just fits the hand to mix metaphors.
Right, exactly. And if you have to learn it, it can become a kind of a gatekeeping thing, sort of a barrier that people use for each other. And sometimes people can get very, zealous about their defense of experiences, which if you look at them kind of from a neutral standpoint, you can say that's actually a little outdated, or that's got a lot of historical context on why that should work that way that isn't bringing any value today.
Well, it is where you find folks defending an older tool because they do. It's almost as if that piece of their expertise is easier to measure and understand. And so they're going to pour energy in defending that tool rather than experiment with the new thing when the value that everyone really wanted and that are actually they have just harder to measure is that domain experience.
Yeah. And I have huge empathy for that, just to be clear, because when people are using a tool that they're comfortable with and you introduce a new tool that they're not comfortable with, then there's a lot of layers going on there for that user. And I can understand lots of different reactions people might have to that. People are in an environment where they're having to learn a lot. They're having to learn a lot about their domain to stay on top of it. And so to add to that, also I have to learn a new tool can feel very unfair.
Yeah.
I mean, and is our intention to make it where by learning this new tool, they're moving ahead and they're staying on top of things kind of naturally.
They're more valuable.
Is more valuable.
They were able to do more valuable things.
But I can totally understand how it can just seem like another thing on the list.
Oh, yeah.
I hear people tell me, I haven't had time to look into notebooks yet.
Right.
And I kind of want to express this, like, it's not something you have to go and read a book about to learn about. It's like, just open one and hit a couple plus buttons and see what it looks like. And I think most people just kind of get it. They have kind of maybe two or three concepts that they need to understand about kernels and compute contexts and then off and running.
Sure.
But so often new tools aren't given to you that way. They're given to you and it's like, now learn Git. And it's like, oh my gosh, let me print out a cheat sheet.
And when you make a mistake, you really will destroy everything, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. Little too powerful a tool. And some of these commands are a bit arcane, but it's also, that's a really old tool. We can blame Linus for that one.
Yes, exactly.
But I also appreciate, and I think you get the sense of this with your tools too. It's like, it's in your best interest to experiment for a while and then maybe go read some docs to try and help. Because until you've had some experiences, the docs don't mean much anyway.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, sometimes it is these days a lot easier to go find a YouTube video some sort of conference presentation or something and just kind of watch it on 2x speed and kind of see what people are doing and kind of get a sense of, oh, okay, I get it. This is actually a problem I run into where I've discovered that if I use Azure Data Studio in front of a user for about 10 minutes, they know more about it than if I talk to them about it for 10 minutes. And I don't know how to write that down. I don't know how to convey that.
Well, shortcut keys. I mean, I had this experience with SMS all the time doing presentations where you're flipping through something and people would stop. You know, the topic is vaguely interesting, but the way you're moving through those windows is way more interesting. How are you doing that? And then you spend 10 minutes realizing your muscle memory of like window flipping and moving pieces between different screens. It's like, that was valuable.
Right.
It's actually the workflow piece.
You know, I have all these old tricks too on, people would ask me how I get my SSMS set up for a presentation. I was like, I actually have a different Windows profile and I have all of my settings set up for conferences over in that Windows profile. And I log in as that user and that user isn't going to accidentally see any files that they shouldn't see because I don't have anything on my desktop and that user is going to have all of the highlighting and font sizes set, you know.
And probably a lower set of privileges, like all of, you know, those things are way more realistic. I think the big thing for me that made me separate my presentation work from my real work was I had very high resolution monitors that you never get a projector for, right?
Yes.
If you're working in 4K all the time, you get used to all this screen space and then you're on a 1080p screen and you are hurt. It's like, I got to close all this.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's a very, very, it's interesting to recognize those are different things. But it also, realize this is one of the issues with, especially with these older tools, which is there is a lot of arcane knowledge, shortcut keys, things like that, that are hard to discover that give you a superpower once you've got them. But I get the sense that the newer tools are more resistant to that, that you tend not to do that same set of arcane shortcuts.
So the approach, at least in Azure Data Studio and often in a lot of the newer tools, is that you have the ability to set those yourself.
Right.
So like in Azure Data Studio, you can download the SSMS key binding set extension. Like if you want to have all those SSMS ones, right, they're right there for you to download.
Right.
You know them, go ahead and download them, but we're not going to assume or enforce that knowledge kind of natively. It's a preference.
Interesting. Just a couple of weeks ago, I had a conversation with an interesting lady who we talked a little bit about ontological design, this idea that not only do we make the tools, but then the tools also make us. Mm-hmm. And you're one of our definitive tool builders here, Vicky. Like, you're making us all the time. Do you see a change in the approach you're doing to tools these days that sort of lead us to a better path?
Yeah. So one of the things that I'm trying to kind of introduce, and this is both an internal and an external concept, is that what does discoverability mean, mm-hmm. right? So there's always this concept of something being easier if you're able to discover it. But if you think about SSMS, you can discover like 800 different things in there. And it's a 747 cockpit right away.
Sure.
And so there's sort of this desire to set an intentionality around what is it that you're trying to do? And now let's give you the set of experiences around what you're trying to do. And so having that mindset of, you know, I'm going to download this tool and I'm going to use it for Postgres and SQL Server, and I don't need to have all of these other things.
Yeah.
Or I'm using it for Postgres only, so I don't need SQL Server Agent.
Mm-hmm.
Or I'm using it for development only, so I don't need, you know, all of the, you know, visualization tools. So I'm trying to introduce that idea that you need to set your expectations around what the tool is kind of as you're going into it, and then it should move smoothly from that. But I think that, but it's been an interesting challenge because mm-hmm. people are used to coming in and everything being at hand. Yeah,
I want my Swiss Army knife and I want to look at all my blades, even though I only need one of them.
Right, exactly. I love one of my PMs was talking about how if you ask, you know, if you were to ask users for, you know, feature recommendations the way that we do with software, and you're talking about cooking and say, well, you know, I need this bread to cut. I need this knife to cut bread. I need it to cut meat. I need it to cut vegetables. And while I'm at it, I might get thirsty while I'm using it. So you should probably put a cup on the end.
Right.
You know, so the idea is that everything becomes a multi-tool.
Yes.
Is what I'm trying to kind of pull away from. It's like, it can be a multi-tool.
Right. And better to have multiple tools that are good at their individual things and integrate well.
Right.
That's always, I think, especially if we have more experience here, we've been burned enough times by integration that we kind of avoid it. We want a tool that does all of the things.
Right.
And I think we're entering a world where, no, I really want individual tools that are good at a particular thing, but also get along well.
Right. And that's where I think that the extension mechanism in Visual Studio and VS Code and then mm-hmm. now in Azure Data Studio is really helpful, because it's like, let's assume a way that these things are supposed to interact with each other, and then you can pick them. So for me, anytime you're having to alt tab between things is kind of a failure in design.
Something's
so you're
wrong.
Alt tabbing, you know, at some level you're saying these are two things people wanted to do, and the only way that they have to get between them is using, you know, operating system notions around changing tabs and copy, you know, cohorts.
Yeah.
Whereas if you use something like an extension mechanism where like there is a way that these are supposed to communicate with each other and expose information to each other that the user doesn't have to do manually.
Right. And so the extension ends up being the special thing you want to do, but it lives in the context of everything else you were doing as well.
Right.
So a little less moving data between.
If you want to change the way that tabs and spaces work in your environment, you should be able to just add that, and you shouldn't have to be like, let me go to the tabs and spaces tool.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's fair. It's an interesting line to draw as to what all you should do or what you shouldn't do. Because I think the other aspect of the data tooling that's gotten really good now is the command line tooling, is that GUI-less approach to managing a database.
Yeah, and that's also so important, both for people who just know what they want to get done and they're not really working in an exploratory. They're not sitting down to type for 2 hours.
Yes.
They're wanting to do this in 15 seconds. The command line tools are great for that. And then for automation purposes, mm-hmm. you want to have a rich command line tool. So one of the things we've done there, kind of note recently, I don't know if you've come across this, is MS equals CLI. Have you seen this at all?
I have, but please tell me all about it.
Okay. So we've had the SQL CMD command line utility for a long time, and it kind of replaced the OSQL utility, and it, you know, allows you to run commands against SQL Server. But if you ever play with it and you actually have like wide result sets or a whole lot of result sets, you know, it just kind of blurts that information up onto the screen, and you're having to type everything manually, etc. So MSQL CLI is a utility that has things like IntelliSense at the command line, mm-hmm. and it has paging, and it has the ability to scroll left and right, and it's multi OS, so is SQL CMD, but you can use it in a lot of the same ways as SQL CMD, but it's really designed for a more interactive experience. SQL CMD always really was more useful in the case that you already had worked out in SSMS or something what you wanted to run, and then you're just going to pipe it in to SQL CMD because it's part of a scheduled job, say.
Yeah, it's a script runner, essentially.
Right. And so we're definitely trying to make some improvements there. And then, of course, PowerShell is you know, best buddies with SQL Server as mm-hmm. well. And that's kind of a command line experience. And then that pulls us back around again. Everything comes back around to notebooks again, because now we have PowerShell notebooks. So you can do your scripting that would be command line scripting, and you can make those cells in a notebook. And so you can then document it.
Well, and that is, you know, the notebook approach is very much actually a CLI approach, where you're issuing a command and able to see the results in place, mm-hmm. Which helps you learn it as well, which I really appreciate. But I think SQL Server, because it had the data modification languages and so forth, like it had its own way to do sort of scriptable things, it came a little later mm-hmm. to a lot of these standardized approaches like the PowerShell approach and the CLI approach. But I appreciate that the set of tools is here now and we're taking a look at.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting too, if you know, if I can go off kind of into my own head on what mm-hmm. I'm thinking about tooling and experiences, is that when you're working directly with SQL Server, when you're talking, you know, port 1433 to SQL Server, you are talking to a declarative engine.
Yes.
And people do not work in declarative modes on average. They are working in procedural and imperative languages. Mm-hmm. They're not working in declarative languages. So in declarative languages, you are saying, you're not telling the server what to do. You're telling it what you want.
Yeah.
And the server figures out what to do about it. And so that transition is something that I think is hard for a lot of people. And so when we put a lot of those things into something like PowerShell, then I think it makes it more natural for people who don't want to transition into a declarative mindset. You know, if you're wanting to do everything with, if you can type naturally in DML and you know the downstream effect of all of that, that's great. If you don't, then go ahead and use SMO or go ahead and use DACFX and let the tooling help you through that.
Show you where you're going.
Yes.
Well, this is a really fun conversation. And you know, there's still more to explore here. Where should folks go for more information, and where would you send them first?
So for information about what we're kind of doing on a monthly basis, mm-hmm. we do post a blog post on the SQL Server blog on Azure. And so that would be the monthly release notes for Azure Data Studio.
Right.
That's also where we post all of the regular releases of SSMS, which themselves are still quite common. Mm-hmm. And so the other thing is actually to follow us on Twitter and on social media. We're a pretty chatty crowd. So you can follow most of these updates do go out through Azure Data Studio, or you can follow me individually on Twitter. And then otherwise, you know, watch the platform announcements at some of the big conferences as they come along, Ignite, Build, Past Summit, things like that. We always have some sort of little blog post coming out about, you know, the state of tooling.
Nice. And of course, these are all going to be virtual events, at least for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, exactly. Which means that we can make it to all of them now, right?
Yeah, I guess that's true. And reach far more people. That's the other thing I'm finding, for sure.
It makes it, it has its challenges, but it also does have its benefits.
Yeah. And we're trying to, I can see everyone just trying to get better at it too.
Yeah. Exactly.
Vicky, so much fun to talk to you. Thanks for spending some time with us.
Absolutely.
And we'll talk to you next time on Run As Radio.